യോഗേന ചിത്തസ്യ പദേന വാചാം മലം ശരീരസ്യ ച വൈദ്യകേന യോപാകരോത്തം പ്രവരം മുനീനാം പതഞ്ജലിം പ്രാഞ്ജലിരാനതോസ്മി സ്തുവേ പതഞ്ജലിം വ്യാസം ശങ്കരം ച മുനിത്രയം കർത്തൃസൂത്രസ്യ ഭാഷ്യസ്യ ക്രമാദ്വിവരണസ്യ ച. So we are continuing the discussion. This 41st sutra deals with the topic which is called in yoga tradition samapatti. Samapatti is samprajnada samadhi. So it is continuation of a discussion that began with 17th verse. Some of you may remember because this is a continuous course. So in the 17th verse it was already mentioned that there are higher forms of concentration, higher levels of concentration as a means to achieve higher tranquility, transcendental insight, eternal peace and happiness. So that discussion actually begins with the 17th sutra of the first chapter, Samadhipada, which deals with the three higher or ascending levels of concentration. Then in the next stage, in 35th sutra, Patanjali discusses different methods to attain mental tranquility, mental peace, mental happiness. So that is an important discussion. That state is technically called in the yoga tradition sthiti nibandhini. Sthiti means when you find yourself mentally established in perfect equilibrium, you are not shaken by anything. So not only is mental stability, but along with that, you feel a kind of inner poise, happiness. Happiness may be not a very adequate expression, a kind of inner contentment. You feel mind to be established in a state of contentment. The word the Patanjali uses called Chitta Prasadanam. So, what is prasada? When we feel a kind of deep, intense contentment. It doesn't mean inaction. It doesn't mean inaction or inactivity, going away from ordinary duties and responsibilities. Rather, it helps us to link ourselves to a higher ideal. So when we have a higher ideal in our mental horizon, then our priorities change. Smaller problems do not shake us because we have something higher in our mind which makes us feel internally, spiritually rich. Well, to a very simple example I can give from very, very ordinary standpoint. Suppose you have billions of dollars in the bank and you somehow lose $5 notes. You won't go about crying and weeping. Because you feel you have something higher, much richer, which is yours. So your attitude towards $100, $1,000 will be different from that of a person. See, if you have got only $2,000 in the bank, and if you lose $1,000, you somehow misplaced somewhere, it will be a terrible thing for you. But not when you have something much higher, which you feel is yours. So yoga helps you to feel this inner richness, inner completeness, tranquility and peace. It is called sthiti nibandhini. So We already mentioned this in the 35th sutra. It is called Vishayavati va Pravartihi Utpanna Manasasthiti Nibandhini. A kind of extra sensory perception helps you to be established in a state of perfect mental poise and happiness. What is meant by extra sensory perception? We have to remember it has nothing at all to do with the occult or the miraculous. What it means, you have an idea of yourself, that you are a transcendental, a higher being. You are not just this psychophysical mechanism. You are not just this body or this mind which fluctuates, which changes. Body falls sick, disappears. Mind also gets happy and unhappy. So these things are not, mind and body, psychophysical mechanism, can never be in a state of perfect inner richness, inner completeness. But when we start looking upon ourselves as something that goes beyond the senses, beyond just a psychophysical being which goes about enjoying or experiencing things at the sensory level, when we start looking upon ourselves as something much bigger, then living in this world, confronting different problems, going about duties and responsibilities will not shock us, will not have a shocking impact on our system, because we have linked ourselves to something higher, transcendental, which by its very nature is steady and blessedness. Now, how to attain this experience? We already discussed this, but I just want to recapitulate to bring you to where we stand right now. One problem which Patanjali anticipates is when we live, when we go about doing our duties and responsibilities, we confront different situations, different types of people. So often, for a spiritual seeker who have not reached the highest goal in his or her aspirations, every moment, every association, every work, every life situation can have some impact on us. Sometimes the impact may not be very pleasant. Associating with people who may make you doubtful about the spiritual path you have undertaken. You feel your convictions are all broken. So, or sometimes we may have to associate with people who may not be very friendly. So how to keep the mind in a state of perfect equilibrium? It doesn't mean insensitivity. Not that you run away from wrong associations. Not that you run away from a place or a workplace or a life situation where you have to confront people who may not be friendly. But it means even while encountering them in different life situations, we have to keep our mind in a state of steadiness. So Patanjali gives a very practical dictum, that is, Maitri Karuna Mudita Upeksha. That's what he says. People who are friendly with you, who are spiritual seekers like you, you should be friendly with them. And those who don't have the good fortune to be associated with spiritual ideas, you should not look down upon them. So Karuna means sympathy. And those who are more advanced, you should not be envious or jealous of them. And then fourth category, those who may cast doubts, suspicions, skepticism, may shake your own conviction, your own faith in what you are undertaking, keep a long distance from them. Mudita Upeksha. These are the four tools that Patanjali puts before you to face problems in spiritual life in general. It's not only related to yoga. These ideas are repeated in many other Vedanta scriptures, Hindu philosophical literature. It's already mentioned in many of our devotional classics. So I'm not going to those things, those contexts. In the last sutra, I mean last Friday, we discussed the sutra. Kshina Prutehi चित्तस्य अभिजातस्य मणिः इव गृहीतृ ग्रहण ग्राह्येषु तत्स्थ तञ्जनता समापत्ति दट्स दि सूत्र विच डील्स विथ समापत्ति. समापत्ति इज ए स्टेट इन विच आवर माइंड मेंटल सिस्टम रिमेन्स इन ए स्टेट ऑफ परफेक्ट इक्वानिमिटी पीस एंड ट्रैंक्विलिटी. वाई? As I mentioned, of course we mentioned, every action produces some residual effects. Every action can leave behind some pleasant, sometimes very unpleasant experiences, memories and impressions. So they manifest as vrittis, as Patanjali used the word, vritti, residual effects, which become strong tendencies called samskaras, and then strong action-oriented tendencies, habit formations called vasanas, and then we may act, our actions, our words, our thoughts are always in a way determined by all the previous thoughts, actions and words that we have encountered. This is a continuous stream we call. So modern psychology, you know, mind is a stream consciousness, continuous consciousness. But Patanjali in his unique way says, it is true, mind is a continuous, unbroken succession of thought currents, stream consciousness. But then, Patanjali, and as interpreted by Vyasa and other commentators, gives a unique contribution to modern psychology. That is the concept of samskara, which you don't find. So, why does a child, or a criminal, or a psychologically handicapped person behave in a particular manner? Well, modern psychology will try to explain the light of experiences he had or she had in the past. True. That is true. That is accepted in Patanjali. Remember, Patanjali's system is 3,000 years. No, because the sutras belong to 1600 BC, so it should be at least 4,000 years old. So, the yoga commentators say, our mental system is full of these impressions. So they say these impressions are divided into two categories, fundamental categories. One positive, which are helpful, the other negative, which are not helpful. Suppose, well, you want to do some noble deed or noble work, meditate or reading a good book, or maybe engaging in some noble activity, or maybe you want to change your regular habits. You want to start some new habit tomorrow onwards. Well, there is resistance. You decide with the intellect. The mind, no. Mind says no. So this resistance of the mind may manifest in the form of procrastination, false justifications that we develop in order to avoid doing that or starting that new venture. So this is what happens. So Patanjali or yoga psychology say there are two fundamental categories of previous impressions, which is called vrittis. One is positive, healthy, helpful, the other negative. If we go on doing good deeds at the physical level, which we have some freedom for, then we may be able to change the balance. We discussed this earlier. Now, this sutra is related to that. What is called kshina vritti, the word used here. The meaning is this. A person or a spiritual seeker at a very high level of concentration is called a niruddha state. Where vrittis are transcended, what happens? These past impressions, good and bad, they are there, but they become non-functional. They are weakened. So, the best way for you to bring about a change in your lifestyle or to change the attitude of a person is, well, to make him, to help him to do things which create good vrittis. The mental system is like a bag. It has got maybe 40% of good impressions, 60% of bad impressions. So when the bad impressions dominate, our tendencies, our actions, words, behavior, character have a tendency to be colored by the negative impressions. So how to weaken these negative impressions? You have to increase the percentage of positive impressions. And what are impressions? Impressions are nothing but the residual effects of our own actions, not physical actions alone. Words we speak, thoughts we think, deeds that we do at a physical level, they all create these vrittis. So go on accumulating an extra, some extra good vrittis, engaging good actions. Then slowly the percentage of good vrittis, good actions, good impressions will increase, and proportionately bad impressions, bad vrittis will be weakened. When this reaches the highest level, through the practice of yama, niyama, asana, pranayama, pratyahara, dharana, as we mentioned earlier, so we have no time to go bigger, we already discussed this earlier, through meditation, internal, external disciplines, withdrawing mind from external senses, diverting mind towards positive channels, and then meditation and prayer. Through these spiritual practices, when we reach a higher level of concentration, these vrittis become kshina, means weakened. Such a person whose vrittis, whose impressions are weakened, that means he has transcended vrittis. Vrittis do not bother him much. Such a person is called kshina vritti. Now, how his mind functions? So here, the sutragara uses a very interesting simile. The example he uses is this. He uses the word, you know, a crystal, a white crystal, which doesn't have a color of its own. Like a mind becomes free from all negative, positive impressions. So, a crystal. Now, when you bring the crystal close to a red flower, the crystal appears to have become red flower, red in color. The crystal doesn't have a color of its own. So this kind of total identification with a higher spiritual ideal is a natural result of this higher concentration as practices. So there is a kshinavrittayo yasya saha kshinavritti tadhavidasya chittasya kshinavrittege. So a person who has done a lot of spiritual practices, prayers, meditation, and practicing non-violence, truthfulness, non-possessiveness, purity of mind, contentment, all this. Such a person, gradually, his store of negative vrittis, negative impressions get weakened. Such a person is called kshina vritti in the Vyasa's commentary. Now, how does such a person's mind function? Like a crystal. A crystal, white crystal, pure crystal, which is quite clean, doesn't have a color of its own. It's like a mental system, it doesn't have a vritti of its own. So when that mind reaches, when it is kept close to a red flower, or anything that has a special color, that crystal reflects that color completely. This is what happens when you do spiritual sadhana, spiritual practices. Now, we should remember, total identification or obsessive identification doesn't necessarily mean yoga. I mentioned this earlier. People with extraordinary power of concentration, great powers of concentration, focus, and ability to dedicate all their intellectual, mental, physical energies for one particular cause may not be a yogi. You take him away from that and ask him to divert the same mind to something higher, he won't be able to do that. I mentioned earlier, you know, there are some of the scourges of humanity had extraordinary powers of mind. Genghis Khan, Attila the Hun, examples are there. Adolf Hitler, terrible powers of concentration. Napoleon was not a bad man, he was a great man in some ways, you know. So you find people who are the scourges of humanity, they also have this strong power to identify themselves, their whole mind, with something, with some higher, not necessarily higher ideal, sometimes very diabolical ideals. That is not yoga. What's the difference? The difference is a yogi, before he reaches this level of samapatti, higher concentration, gets established in two sets of moral disciplines, which we discussed many times elaborately, yama and niyama. Yama means ahimsa, satya, asteya, brahmacharya, aparigraha, means non-violence, physically, mentally, intellectually, verbally, you practice non-violence. You get so established in non-violence that you don't have to worry about the ideal of non-violence. It becomes your natural characteristic. So that's the real definition given by Shankaracharya. He has written a very wonderful commentary on these statements. It's called Vyasabhashya Vivarana. So he says, when you really get established in truthfulness, then you don't have to worry about, oh, I should be very careful, I should not tell a falsehood. Because truthfulness, truth speaking becomes natural to you. Just as false speaking also becomes natural to certain people. The other example also is there. So, non-violence. So then truthfulness, satyasteya means non-stealing others, the literal translation. In a general way, it means not having any desire for things which don't belong to us. Then chastity, purity of life. And then non-receiving gifts means a kind of total freedom from possessiveness of mind. Greed, so to speak. Freedom from greed, freedom from desire for things that belong to other people. Freedom from any violent tendency for violent deed, violent word, any kind of violence. In speech, in word, in deed, in thoughts, we should practice non-violence. So these are five disciplines. And then as a result of these disciplines, you feel a kind of contentment. If you want to identify a truly spiritual person, you will have one important quality, contentment. Contentment is not going about singing songs, having enjoy, cutting jokes, having what you call feel good. Everything, not that sort of superficial display of merry joking, not that sort of thing. Contentment is very serene, very blessed, very deep and very real. Contentment is what helps you to remain unshaken by challenges, by negative experiences or by wrong associations, or this is the contentment. This contentment becomes natural. The real, the term used in the yoga system is santosha. So if you go to the dictionary, the literal meaning is, joy or happiness. Not at all. It is not happiness. In fact, a person who is really contented, he goes beyond happiness and unhappiness both. If you are always looking for happiness, you are bound to be unhappy at some point of time. So you should be able to transcend both. To be really happy, you should stop looking for happiness. To be really happy, one should stop looking for happiness. So, Chauja, Santosha, Tapaswadhyaya, Isapridhana, internal purity, external purity, then concentration, austerity, and also feeding the mind with good thoughts, reading, associating, actions, words. Mind also needs food. So, Isvapranidhana actually means resignation to a higher spiritual ideal. That's what it means. So, when you get fully established in these disciplines, and then when you reach a very high level of concentration, then only you become a spiritual person. So, that's very important. People ask these questions now. They want to increase the power of concentration. Increasing power of concentration without some moral discipline is not only useless, it is positively dangerous actually, in the higher sense. Power of concentration is nothing but power of mind. So that is not only useless, but it is positively dangerous. That's why, as a stroke of genius, Patanjali lays down, before you enter yoga or deep spiritual practice, you should be fully established in these 10 disciplines. So that's why the abhijatasya maneha, mani actually means crystal. The word abhijata actually means superior, higher. Abhijata actually means somebody is born in a good family, cultured family, that's literal meaning. Means superior, a noble, a beautiful crystal, which is pure. When it is kept close to any object, it assumes the color of that object. Like that, if you do spiritual practice, you should be able to identify yourself with that high core, high ideal. It means, psychologically, one important point is implied here. Total freedom from conflict. That's what it means. When we try to meditate, the mind agitates, then there is a problem. There is no identification. It means the crystal has some dust or filth or dirt about it. That's what it means. So it doesn't reflect. It doesn't reflect the color of the flower. So that's why in the Sanskrit tradition, it's called Yad Bhavayadi Tad Bhavati. The statement the Shankaracharya quotes in the Vivarana means, whatever you think of, that you become. For a yogi, just one split second, if he thinks of something, he can identify with that. For others, whatever you constantly think of, you will become that. So if you look at Buddha's picture, he's not staring at something. He's not looking at anything, but he's not sleeping. He's not sleeping, and he apparently has not opened his eyes. This is meditative. Just being an example, popular picture. So where is he looking at? What is he looking at? Certainly he's not sleeping. Eyes are not closed when you meditate. Eyes are not open, wide open either. That's a principle in meditation. You should not close the eyes, because then you will sleep, or you will have the image of darkness on the mental horizon. So you will be meditating upon darkness at the beginning. If you open the eyes, then the visual objects will drag your mind into those things. So it will be a distraction, or it will be an obstacle, it will be a dissipation. So that's why Lord Krishna in the Gita says, one should not keep the eyes closed, one should not keep the eyes open, but rather one should, as if looking at the tip of the nose. That is the Gita statement. You should not be staring at the tip of the nose, then that tip of the nose will become the object of meditation. So Shankaracharya, right in the commentary, he says, Eva, he uses the word Eva in the commentary, means as if, not really speaking. It should not be. As if you are looking at it, not really. So that is emphasized, not really. So that's why, Samankaya Shirogrivam Dharayan Ajalam Stiraka Samprekshan Asigagram Swam Disascha Anavalokayan. This is a Gita verse. So Samankaya Shirogrivam, this is posture. Then he says, Samprekshan Asigagram, literal meaning of the verse is, you should be looking at the tip of the nose. But Shankaracharya writes, Samprekshya Iva, as if, which means you should not close your eyes, you should not open your eyes. So what does it mean? It means he is identifying himself with what he meditates upon. So just like crystal completely assumes the color of the red flower close to which it is kept, so also when a spiritual seeker meditates on a high ideal or a great saint, he will naturally imbibe the qualities of a great saint. So that is an important thing to remember. So I've seen this, because I've seen pictures, I won't mention, pictures of 10,000 people assembled in a big ground praying, and there's a terrible terror on their eyes. They're looking towards the sky. It's clear that what they're trying to meditate or what they're praying to is not a very compromising type of person. He certainly is very, very strict, some sort of a non-nonsense type of person. That's not how we meditate. We meditate on the presence of the divine reality present, not above the clouds, but within ourselves. So that's why the Buddhist philosophers say, there is a statement there. That is when antardrishti means where you look towards inward within, you focus on the presence of the divine within you, then what happens? You become fully calm and quiet. Not when you look outward, but when you look inward. Through this meditation, one identifies oneself with what he is or she is meditating upon. That's why in the earlier sutra, 39th sutra says, yatha abhimata dhyana dva, the 39th sutra says, one way of reaching transcendental level of meditation is to meditate upon the life and teachings of a great saint whom you admire for his or for her great qualities. Yatha abhimata dhyanatva. Suppose you read the teachings of a great saint and then you think deeply, you meditate on that saint or that the teachings of that great saint, what happens? Your mind slowly will be influenced by his personality, by his teachings. That's the first step towards meditating on God. So, one of the great commentators, modern commentators, has quoted a very interesting portion from St. John of the Cross, Living Flame of Love, the first stanza, which is almost a verbatim repetition of this Patanjali Sutra. What is the sutra? That is, Abhijadasya Manehiva, just like a pure, noble, clean crystal, reflects the color of the flower close to which it is kept. So also, a person who meditates on God as the embodiment of compassion, his personality begins to completely, fully reflect that divine ideal on which he or she is meditating. So she uses the word, there is a similar statement in St. Teresa of Avila, I was trying to mix up it. This is St. John of Cross. If the soul reaches the supreme degree of love, the love divine shall have struck here in her deepest center, and it will be for the soul the transformation and illumination of all her being according to the might and fervor of which she is capable, and even so, that she shall seem to be God. That means when you meditate upon God, you identify yourself with God. Not that you start thinking yourself you are the God. When you meditate upon a higher ideal, you become that higher ideal. Or you assume some qualities or properties or characteristics of that higher ideal that you meditate upon. That's an important principle. This comes from St. John of the Cross. She is then like an extremely transparent and pure crystal. So the word mani is used in Patanjali's yoga. Abhijadasya manehe iva. And St. John of the Cross uses the word crystal. Crystal is nothing but mani. She is then like an extremely transparent and pure crystal, struck by light. The more intense the rays of light and the more crystal absorbs them, and concentrates them in itself, the more it sparkles. It may even happen that if the light received is superabundant, the crystal itself shall be confounded with it and will not be distinguished from the rays, since it absorbs all it can receive of their clarity and seems to have become light. So the crystal completely absorbs, reflects, and transmits the light that it reflects. It depends upon the purity, the cleanliness, the transparency of the crystal. For this crystal here, we are the crystal. To be more precise, our own mind, our chittam, is the crystal. Patanjali uses the word chittam. We are, after all, not a physical body. Body doesn't reflect God or anything. It is our character, our tendencies, our impressions, which together, all together, constitute chittam. So remember, in the yoga and Vedanta, our true personalities is defined as antakarana or internal organs. In a way, mind with which we speculate, intellect with which we decide, take decisions, and memory system where we store the memories of past impressions and experiences, and our own ego, because we identify ourselves with something that we have experienced. So we remember all these events. So depending upon the purity of the reflecting medium, the crystal or the mirror, the reflection is effulgent or sparkles. So that's what St. John of the Cross says. Interesting, he used the word crystal, I mean almost the same word which is used by Patanjali. So now there are a few more words used in this sutra which focus on the total transparency and identity of our mind with what we meditate upon. So there are two words used here. One is tatstha, the other is tanjanata. So that's very interesting. So how it really helps us, this higher concentration. One benefit is we become still. Again, I mentioned earlier, when we link ourselves to a higher spiritual ideal, and when that higher spiritual ideal is a permanent, stable, eternal, unchanging ideal, then we also become of this unchanging character of the ideal that we meditate upon. Colors or influences our own mind. Our mind also becomes calm and quiet. That's the idea behind. So tatstha means the crystal identifying itself with that. But the crystal should not have its own color. It should be still. Then only it can completely identify the color of the flower close to which it's kept. So stability, so this word, the Sanskrit word is tat, stha, which means to stand, stability, to remain in a state of unchanging, stable condition. Stability is not insensitivity. This stability of mind is associated with a feeling of inner blessedness. So that should be understood. Frequently we interpret spirituality or sainthood as being totally insensitive. You are not shaken by anything. Without any human sensitivity. No. It is not devoid of human sensitivity. Only it is not shaken. It is not. It doesn't get disturbed by the changing phenomena, by the changing experiences that we encounter. Because the crystal itself is stable. You remove the red flower and keep a blue flower, the crystal becomes blue. You keep something else and the crystal assumes that color. Because the crystal is stable. It is fully established. So these meditation techniques will help you to achieve sthiti nibandhini, which we discussed in the 35th sutra of the same chapter. We should remember that, you know, frequently you find here in the 35th, Vishayavadiva Pravritti Rutpanna Manasa Sthiti Nibandhini. Pravritti actually means a state of stability, total freedom from any disturbance. Vishoka Jyotishmadi. Vishoka means Vigata, Shoka means all grief, all concern, all disturbing tendencies are completely gone and established in a state of stability and blessedness. Blessedness is an important characteristic of this experience. What is blessedness? Blessedness, prasannada is the word used in Patanjali system. It means it's almost serene, stable, a kind of inner poise, not disturbed by anything. At the same time, not insensitive. You can be insensitive and be stable. It is not that kind of stability. Every great spiritual person is very, very sensitive. You cannot name one great spiritual person from any tradition who was not spiritually sensitive. So when they feel the presence of the Lord within them, that experience manifests in the form of compassion towards others, as you find in Buddha. In the teachings of Lord Krishna, what he says is, when you feel, when you not just believe in, but experience the presence of the divine within you, you also experience the presence of the same divine in everyone outside. So then you look upon the whole creation, not only human beings, as one spiritual family. So you cannot do any harm to anybody. You identify yourself with the whole creation. So these twofold sensitivities will be natural when this concentration reaches its peak of experience. On the one hand, you feel a kind of inner poise, sthiti nibandhini means inner poise, happiness, blessedness. And it is associated with blessedness. Blessedness is not being just happy, deep inner divine contentment. And that expressing itself in your interaction with others as a kind of spiritual comradeship, looking upon the whole creation as one spiritual family. So this is the session. Today we will conclude. So we have interaction for about 10 minutes. Those of you who are interested, asking questions, most welcome. Yeah. You want to ask?
Thank you. Thank you very much for the discourse. It was very good. I have a question. So it seems to me like there are a few schools of thought. During meditation, there is one school of thought that says it's essentially art of living. The kind of meditation is, it says you think about nothing. And what they teach you as part of it is, if your mind gets disturbed, they ask you to utter a mantra to get you back into concentration. So that's one school. And then listening to this, it seems to me like there is also a school of thought which says you meditate on a spiritual higher level of consciousness. So I was wondering, is there a difference between the both, or are they both saying the same thing?
You know, this meditation on nothingness, it has sprung from two schools of Buddhist philosophy. One is the doctrine of emptiness called Shunyavada. The other one is Sautrantika. It's a kind of Vijnanavada, or subjective idealism. So when you transcend the realm of thought currents, you stop identifying yourself with any thought. So the nothingness that you identify with is not the absence of anything. It is, so the word shunya, I shall just speak a few words about the original concept. Nagarjuna is the great exponent of the Shunyavada. He wrote the well-known, it's a Bible of Shunyavada, is called Mamula Madhyama Shastra or Madhyamika Karika. Like, so that's the original text, which the, like what is Bible for Christianity, this book is the Bible of Shunyavada, Doctrine of Emptiness. So Nagarjuna explains Shunya. So Shunya is the Paramarthika Satta, means the absolute reality. And Samvriti Satta is the relative realm. These are two levels of reality which Nagarjuna expounds. Of course, he quotes Buddha actually. Deshemi Baudhata Satyam, that's how the verse comes in the Mula Madhyame Karika. So Shunya is not nothingness as we understand in the dictionary. When you do not identify yourself with anything, then you expand, you actually identify with everything. When you identify yourself with something which can be defined or clearly explained, then you limit yourself. So the word Shunya is defined by the original philosopher Nagarjuna as non-dual, as a transcendental, as the absolute reality, which cannot be explained in empirical terms. So it is beyond definition, beyond description, beyond explanation by words and thoughts. It is something that we can only experience. In that respect, Nagarjuna uses the word shunyam, it is called shunyata. So if you define, so in fact, it would be interesting, somebody like you, you know, there is a commentary by Chandragirti on Moola Madhyamika Karika. So he says, it is wrong to call Shunya Shunya, because if you name it, you define it, then it ceases to be Shunya. Shunya in English means empty, nothingness. If you define something as nothingness, then it's no more nothingness. It becomes something. You define it, you are putting a frame. So that's why interesting, Chandragirti has written a commentary on this book. So while explaining what Shunya is, you know, Buddhist scholars were great Ayurvedic physicians, like in Vagbhadananda, who wrote many of our great Ayurvedic books were Buddhist actually. So Chandragirti, the commentator on Madhyamika Karika, is a very funny and very revealing example, illustration to drive home this idea. He says, suppose you have stomach pain and you take a medicine, a root in those days, and then you are cured of the stomach problem, but the root remains, that also should be removed. So he says, Shunya is not Shunya. Then what is Shunya? Shunya is the undefinable, indescribable reality. So all the terms that Nagarjuna used to explain Shunya as something beyond explanation are used by Shankaracharya in the Advaita classics. That's one thing. Again, I want to tell you, modern teachers have reduced many of these great ideas, simplified many of these ideas, and have developed many meditation techniques. So they may be useful, but why right now we are discussing the original philosophical classics, which constitute the source books of meditation, yoga, everything. So Patanjali's Yoga Sutra is the Bible of yoga, psychology and yoga philosophy. Okay, thank you.
From the finite to the infinite, with cosmic laughter and the mystery of life, is the
cosmic laughter.
Cosmic laughter, cosmic humor. There's a certain joyful search here, where the divine is seeking to know itself. Is that true?
Yeah, the divine is not seeking to know itself. We are rediscovering what we actually are, which we forgot for the time being. We are the one trying to find out ourselves. That is the Advaitic, and that is also the yogic approach. In yoga, you know, the purpose, according to Patanjali, Sankhya and Kapila and Patanjali, you know, the final goal of yoga is what we call, you know, reverse evolution. What is reverse evolution? We have traveled a long distance from our source. We are actually Purusha, the consciousness. But then we identify ourselves with many things, many of the evolutions of Prakriti. So, to give an example, what is called reverse evolution? So you should know what is evolution. So in the yoga system, which borrows the philosophical content from Sankhya system, Purusha and Prakriti are two fundamental categories. Purusha is consciousness, but inactive, it doesn't evolve into anything. Prakriti is unconscious, but it is the mother of all evolution, source of all evolution. So from Prakriti, Mahat comes, Mahat Tattvam, the cosmic, subtle cosmic reality. From that, the ego system, Ahankara, Buddhi. From that, Buddhi, and from Buddhi, Ahankara comes. So Prakriti, Mahat Tattvam, Buddhi, then Ahankara. So the ego system. From that, all the whole creation emerges. Our own mind, our senses of perception, senses of action, and also the empirical universe, the phenomenal universe. These are all objects which are jada, which are unconscious. So what has happened is, we are actually, our true identity is that we are Purusha, we are the consciousness, we are the Atman, the conscious reality. But we identify ourselves with the unconscious evolutes of unconscious Prakriti. So the five senses of action, the mind, intellect, and the objective universe that we confront, that we experience, that we interact with. So when you see an object, you define yourself as the one who sees that object, and you consider that object as yours. So often we have deluded ourselves into thinking that we are not Atman. And we have deluded ourselves into thinking that we are these dead evolutes of Prakriti. So, in a way, reverse involution means what? Or reverse evolution, or called involution. Reverse evolution means we should dissociate, non-identify ourselves with the object universe. So when you see objects, when you interact with object universe or different things, you should not identify yourself with them. You should not identify yourself with the mind or the intellect or the ego system. So once you stop identifying yourself with all these subjective empirical phenomena, then you are going backward to your home. And then you find your true nature is Purushatman, your consciousness. So yoga helps you to reverse the evolutionary process. It's called involution. That's what actually yoga is trying to do. Take you back to Prakriti and then identify yourself. You are not actually even Prakriti or its evolutes. You are the Purusha, the Atman. So that is the purpose of yoga. In a way, I tell you, indirectly, in all spiritual traditions, where you feel you have a kingdom, you have a house which you have left behind, and you're wandering the city somewhere and trying to rent home in so many places, leaving your own palatial home somewhere, and suddenly you thought you're a homeless man. And you tried to rent a home in the city in different places. But suddenly you discover, oh, I have my home there far away. You're coming back to your home. That's, in a sense, that could be said about all traditions. So you think of Judaism, for example, the covenant, in going back, the Christianity going back to the kingdom. You know, the archangel being driven out, thrown out of the heavens, and the whole humanity is being tempted by the archangel, the devil, the Satan, to tempt, you know, and the saint, and Jesus, and of course the saint, they together are trying to take you in the right direction. Satan is hiding somewhere in the corner, trying to take you in his route. So, now remember, but your real home is the kingdom of heaven. You have to get back to your own home. In Vedanta or Hinduism, you know, you see, you, this kind of, even in Sankhya, kind of involution or reverse evolution. Say, Vedanta says, liberation, spiritual liberation, spiritual enlightenment is your true nature. You have hypnotized yourself. That is Vivekananda's word. Swami Vivekananda says, the whole process of spiritual practices is a kind of dehypnotization. We have hypnotized ourselves into thinking that we are this physical body, this psychophysical mechanism, going about enjoying things and forgetting our true identity, identifying ourselves with all these different things, which are things of a few minutes. We have left our home behind. So, spiritual practice is nothing but turning the journey homeward. In a way, it is true of all traditions. That's a very surprising common ground. You have left a very sublime state behind, and you have left the desert now, and you should go back to your home. This is true of all traditions. Of course, in the meantime, you know, the hell will come, the purgatory will come, which Jesus Christ never talked about. That's a different matter. That will come. These are all man-made structures which I don't want to explain. But in essence, you find in Judeo-Christian traditions, in Buddhist traditions, and in Vedanta, everywhere you find the idea that we are, our true nature is that we are perfect, we are the Atman. We are of a much higher nature than how we think about ourselves right now. So we have to go back to our home. This is the essence of all religious traditions. You go to meditate, you pray in a church or a temple, only for this, to go back, you want to go back to your own home. Once you keep that in mind, you don't feel you are late. Or the devil is sitting somewhere in a corner threatening you, or you should be afraid of somebody. Nothing of the kind. You just become a good human being, try to meditate, practice this discerning mind, self-control, self-restraint, and you start your own homeward journey, because you are going backward towards yourself. You are forgotten there is a divine God whom you are searching for is actually within you. But you are searching for him all over the world, except the place where he actually is sitting. Anyway, so I shall conclude this with a very interesting analogy from one of our classics. It's a very interesting mythology, but it's a great message behind. You know, Bhagavata Purana is a famous classic in our tradition. It was written by Vyasa, and actually he was a very depressed person, he was a great philosopher and author, but he got peace of mind after he wrote this wonderful book. This is a very interesting story of a sage, little boy, a saint. He was a saint. And Sri Ramakrishna considers him as the greatest saint of all times. His father was a demon. His father was a criminal. He was Hiranyakashipu. His hobby was going about disturbing good people, creating problems for everyone. You know, that was his hobby. He was a very evil person, demon. But his son was a saintly person. So this demon, with a huge mace and weapons in his hands, was going about in search of God. I shall hit him. I shall give him a piece of my mind. But God went and hid himself in the heart of his son, because this demon won't search for his search with. For God in the heart of his own son. So the Bhagavata Purana is full of verses. Those who search for God outside in temples or churches or man-made structures And without recognizing the presence of God within the heart of all living beings, their search is in vain. It doesn't mean that you should not pray or anyway, not at all. You can pray. The point is, we should be able to see the presence of God even when we are not in a temple or a church. We should feel the presence. This is a goal. The ultimate goal is to feel the presence of the divine even outside the temple, outside the church, outside the Buddhist temple or any man-made structures. That is the essence of this philosophy. We'll continue later. Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu.